Welcome to Bristol Crime Fest, the last day, sadly. I'm Peter Guthries, the Observer's crime critic, and I'm a crime author. And I'm very pleased to be chairing this panel, which is my idea, so I hope it's going to work, especially with this very august panel. In the empty chair is M.R. Hall, who I don't know where he is, but I hope he might arrive at some stage during the event, so imagine him there. Immediately next to him, or immediately next to the empty chair, is the legendary Simon Brett. 84 novels, 84 books this guy has written. So if he doesn't know about endings, I don't know who will.
But if the first one had sold, you know.
Next to him, Andrew Lane, who's kicking off a young Sherlock Holmes series very, very soon, which is very exciting. And immediately next to me, Jeremy Duns, who's an ace Cold War spy thriller author. We're going to be talking about endings, and it was my idea largely because I've just published a trilogy or two out of a trilogy of books set in Brighton. And I took a risk in the first one, which is called City of Dreadful Night, and didn't quite resolve everything at the end. And on the whole, critics have been kind about this, but I have been getting a couple of emails, one of which I'll just briefly read before I pass over to these guys. I was in Brighton years ago and thought I'd particularly enjoy this book, City of Dreadful Night. Imagine my surprise on page 243 to read, "To be continued." I haven't felt this ripped off since the last time I read Rita Mae Brown and she concluded, "And then I woke up." Needless to say, it's been years since I picked up one of her books, and I'm not likely to pick up another of yours either. But I see that as a selling opportunity. Every complaint is a selling opportunity. But anyway, one of the things about the genre is that there are certain conventions we're expected to meet, obviously, and one of those things is resolving things at the end. How does that work for you, Simon? Are you very good at resolving everything?
I suppose, yes. I mean, one wants a solution and a resolution. And sometimes, I mean, it's quite fun to sort of play with the reader. And certainly in one of my books, one of the Charles Parris books, a comedian dies at the end on the last page. It says, "So, Charles, who did it?" And Charles gives the wrong name for reasons of plot. But this is to deal with those bastards who turn to the last page.
You know who you are.
Yeah. So, I also think, I mean, what one used to get was that, you know, always, usually in the library, you know, with Hercule Poirot, you may be wondering why I've asked you here. And then it goes through about a screed of about 8 pages of, you know, he couldn't have done it because the top was never on the toothpaste, that kind of thing. And then, you know, point to the guy. And I think they were lucky in some respects because they had the death penalty. And I'm not in favour of the death penalty for any reason other than crime fiction. but it was then wonderful, because the moment that Hercule pointed his finger at someone, you know, end of story.
A perfect resolution, yeah.
So we haven't got that now.
It's true. Yeah. But what about you, Andrew? I mean, you're dealing with past times, but I guess that obviously there wasn't the death penalty. Does that make it easier for you, or has that not come up yet?
Well, at the moment, I'm writing fiction for the young adult market, so I'm trying to avoid ideas of people hanging and horrible things happening to them. There's so much you've got to kind of circle your way around when you're writing young adult fiction. But I generally hate endings, because when you start off a book, all your options are open. You can go anywhere you want, and then as you work your way through the book, things are closing down gradually, and you get to the sharp end, the final chapter, and basically you've got all the cards in your hand, and there are no options left. So it's the most boring part of the book is actually that last little bit of explanation.
How about you? Is it the same for you?
I was just thinking when we were talking about it earlier that for my first book, Free Agent, about halfway through, I had an ending in mind, and then about halfway through, I was walking along and suddenly thought of a different ending, and I was so pleased with this idea. I thought, this is brilliant, this changes everything, this is, you know, genius, wonderful. I was really, really pleased with myself. And then when I finished the book and I showed it to my wife, she said, yeah, I really, really liked it, but, you know, that ending is absolutely appalling and you need to change that ending. And I sort of stuck, but I was still convinced this was a brilliant ending, and it took a lot of people, including my agent, to say, there is no way you can use this ending, it won't work. And I became really, really attached to this ending and thought
nice.
I still think it would have worked. But then in the end I saw, you know, although it was a really good ending in a way, it was really sort of, I think it was a clever idea, it sort of undermined lots of other things. So although it was satisfying on an intellectual way, emotionally it would, you know, you felt cheated, which is what my wife was saying. It worked in one way, but in another way it was annoying. And I think the last thing you should do, although you clearly already have done it, but the last thing you should do is annoy the reader with your ending. Sorry.
But have you considered in the e-book version, you can have, give the readers a choice towards the end. Do you want the ending that everybody likes, or do you want the ending that nobody likes?
Yeah, exactly. I think that would be a hard choice for people to make.
In fairness to me, all I meant by the to be continued was that the trilogy is going to continue, but a lot of things do get resolved. But yes, it was slightly unfortunate that. But it is all resolved in the third one, so you know, if there's any readers left by the time of the third one, which is doubtful. But what about actual... you said about that last line where you identify the wrong person, but how carefully do you like to craft that ending? I think Mickey Spillane said... the first sentence of a book sells that book, and the last sentence sells the next book. Mm. I mean, is it really important for you to have a really good closing line or closing lines?
Yes, I like to, but the ones I'm writing at the moment, it seems a kind of diminuendo at the end. You know, there's a little, it goes a bit quiet. that's just. But I'm taking up your point of, you know, when as the nearer you get to the end, that it is just typing, really, is because you know so much. I mean, it's always with a book. It's the beginning that you rewrite, and you sort of think, oh, yes, it's important that she had red hair or whatever. I must put that in chapter one. And, you know, you keep going back to various bits. But when you get to the end, I find it's just a sort of race between my energy and how fast I can type. You know, I know that I won't sort of sleep or anything until I finish the bloody thing. And I quite often, I mean, I finished a book a few weeks ago, and, you know, I have a kind of daily target of number of words when I'm writing a book. And I did 10 days' work in the last 2 days, you know, because I just couldn't get shot of it. You know, like that, and I knew I wouldn't relax at all until I had.
I think I bumped into you in Scarborough somewhere.
Yes, it was shortly after that that I finished it. And it's very strange because, you know, I have this target, and I reckon I know how long I'm going to spend writing a book. And the sort of for the first month, you know, you just slip further and further behind this target. And it is wonderful. I mean, the computer, because writers are notorious for being the most skillful deployers of displacement activity in the world. You know, we can always find something else to do. And the computer has made it wonderful. You know, you can sort of do word counts, and then you can say, at this rate, and then you get out the calculator. And then you can, you know, you can look up your Amazon ranking and really depress yourself. And, you know...
The fonts are good as well. Lots of, you know, I'll make it this font. And
Very good.
Title
yes.
should be that side, actually.
Yes.
Now. Well,
yes.
And drop caps on the first word of the paragraph.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is that the same for you? Do you feel that by the end, apart from that ending that you changed, that it is kind of just typing? Or are you still in some doubt about how it's going to end, in fact?
With my second one, I wrote the ending quite early on, just actually to avoid that feeling, because I knew that, you know, I'd be so sick of it. So I thought, you know, I know how it's going to end, so I just sort of roughed out that where it was to make it sort of easier when I got to it, that it would be less painful to do. Because, yeah, you do get a bit... Exactly as Andrew was saying, that you know what's going to happen, and all the options have narrowed down, and by that stage you've sort of lived with it for quite a long time, so you just do want to get rid of it. So I kind of deliberately factored that in.
Yeah. What about you, Andrew? Do you feel that you're typing by the end, as Simon indicated?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I actually strangely used my next door neighbour as a reader, because he's got very similar tastes to me in terms of literature, and the past couple of books I've given the manuscripts to him to read, and he's come back a couple of days later and he said, "You got so bored by the end of this, didn't you?" Oh yeah, thank you very much. the other thing I find is that it's a bit like cooking. You kind of bake the whole thing and put it in the oven, and you get to the end, I find I've got a little set of ingredients off to one side that I forgot to put in. And that's happened twice on the Young Sherlock Holmes books, because the third one is out in a couple of weeks' time. And in the third one, I'd actually created a villain. And in discussions with my editor, I decided that he had, I can't remember what the medical term is, but a condition where you kind of grow hair all over your body.
Hairiness.
Thank you. That is exactly the one. Thank you for that. And so I put all these hints in during the course of the book that he's kind of obsessively shaving himself, and he's got little cuts everywhere. And Sherlock, as a 14-year-old, can't quite work out why this guy keeps on disappearing off and has little cuts. And then, as I was focusing down towards that sharp end of the book, I never had room to actually explain the fact that he was massively hairy. So I got to the end of the book, and it's all resolved, and then he's gone. oh, what have I done? So I'm going to have to bring him back in another book in order to explain what I've had, which was not the intention.
No, but I think that what you were saying about every complaint is an opportunity. I think precisely that the things that you've forgotten, those ingredients on the side.
The pine nuts in the saucer.
Yeah, but you think, well, you know, I'll use them again. You know, that's stuff that you can use somewhere else.
Well, clearly you've got to write the book to which you're ending is the perfect ending, haven't you? I mean, you've got to start another book, and this ending that you couldn't use on the other book, you build up to it, you see, because I'm sure that ending is wonderful, you know, you mustn't waste it.
Well, apparently it's not wonderful.
I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful in a different book, possibly?
Possibly, yes. Maybe at some point it will. I do think that ideas kind of, gestate over time, and then perhaps an idea that isn't right now, in a few years' time, you realise where it fits in.
Yeah.
The other thing I've done is, and I'd like to know how common this is, I kind of use these little unexplained elements as blackmail material for my publishers, in that I had a 3-book deal for young Sherlock Holmes, and in the first book I introduced a housekeeper into his aunt and uncle's house, who is obviously evil and obviously has a backstory of some kind, and then I conspicuously failed to reveal that backstory in the first, second and the third book. And my editor phoned me up and said, when are you going to reveal the whole story about what she's doing in the house and why she's got such power? Would you have to give me a new contract for 3 more books to do?
Extremely cunning.
That's a man after my own heart.
So,
I like that.
So she did, and I'm explaining it in the fourth book.
Brilliant.
Kind of allied to that, in the first of this trilogy, I gave a character a name, Leslie White was the name I gave her, and in the second book, she's only a minor character, in the second book I gave her a totally different name, and I didn't realise this, and nobody else picked up on this, and in the third book I suddenly thought, oh my God, what have I done? And so I actually made that a plot point in the third book. Why has this woman got 2 different names? Well, partly because Peter's an idiot, but actually, for the purposes of the plot, we'll do it a different way.
It looked deliberate.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But what about, am I gathering from what you're all saying that you all plot in advance quite specifically, or am I getting that wrong?
Well, I would say yes, I do, but less so. I mean, I used to plot much more in advance because I was terrified of not finishing the book. But now, and it used to be before, well, when I was writing and still had a day job, you know, it was 30 pages and I could write the first 30 pages of a book. And then, you know, I'd run out of energy because I would start as soon as I had the idea, whereas now doing it full time, I don't. And I remember what cured me of that was I was with my wife, we were on holiday in Spain, and I had this idea for a book, and we were in one of those sort of tall tower blocks on the seafront with a swimming pool, sort of between us and the sea, and the swimming pool was cracked and empty. And I had this image of a man hurtling down from the balcony above and splashed into the swimming pool. And I thought, oh, that's great, I'm only writing this thing. And then an investigator came out from England to investigate the crime. And this was the clever bit, that actually, because of the time difference, he would have had to know that the crime was going to happen to get out on the flight. He did, you see. And I did something then, which I wouldn't do now, and I talked to my wife about work in progress. And I said, and the clever thing is, you see, because of the time difference, he would have had to know the murder was going to happen to get it. And she said, but it works the other way. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the time difference, he would have had an extra hour to catch the... So I've still got it.
Put that with his ending.
Yeah,
who knows?
Exactly. You may exactly. This would... And I've got this file that an orange file, and it just says Spanish book. And it is 30 pages. But actually, it's a bad sign that I haven't got a title, because I can't really write without a title.
Oh, really? Do titles come first?
Yeah, absolutely. And often, in part, a lot. I mean, I guess the series I'm writing at the moment, you know, they all tend to be a venue. So the shooting in the shop, you know, the poisoning at the pub, that kind of thing. But I mean, once you've got, you know, you've got the setting, you've also got a lot of the characters, because if it's a pub, there's going to be a landlord, there's going to be bar staff, there are going to be regulars, that kind of thing. So, no, I've very rarely changed a title.
Right.
Though, in fact, my first published book, was for Gollancz, and Livia Gollancz was my editor. And it was the first Charles Paris book, and it had a kind of vaguely Cinderella backstory. And so I called it Baron Hardup, because Baron Hardup is, as we know, Cinderella's father, and that sort of suited Charles Paris. And I don't think Livia was familiar with the Cinderella story, and she thought it was just a dirty joke. So I changed it, and I came up with this title, which was Cast in Order of Disappearance, which I think is a great title, but absolutely wrong for that book. You know, one day, as you must use your ending, I must write the book that should be called Cast in Order of Disappearance.
I mean, are titles, like we're talking about endings, I guess titles, we can go the other end. Titles important to you?
Very much. As with Simon, I can't start a book unless I actually know what the title is. And sometimes it'll change as things go on, but I need to have that in mind, because that kind of sets the direction for the whole book. But with the first of the Young Sherlock books, it was I wrote it as The Colossal Schemes of Baron Maupertuis, which is a quote from Conan Doyle. It's one of the unexplained cases. And I submitted the manuscript to Macmillan, and they said, oh, this title's a bit too long. If we actually print that whole thing on the cover, it'll be in really, really small letters. So I had to change it to a two-word title, which is probably the stupidest excuse for changing a title there.
very practical.
Absolutely. Yeah. What about you? Titles important?
They are important to me, but I don't have. It's not the starting point. It's not the trigger for the book for me. But I do think about them a lot. And for my trilogy, which I'm now writing the fourth book in, as it were. but for my first three books, I came up with. Free Agent was the first one, and then the second one was Free Country, and then the third one was Free World. And that took me a lot of weeks of thinking about it, and I was extremely pleased that I'd done it, because I thought it all worked and very well. But now my publisher actually wants to change the second and third book title. So I think there's a danger. I think with all of this stuff, if you get too attached to it, I think it's they can be starting points, and they can sort of trigger ideas, and they can think of a lot of tonal things as well. But then if you take them away, in the end, you've changed the title to a two-word title, but, you know, it's the book that counts. But if it helped you, you know, sort of get to that point, then that's a good thing. But, I mean, the title doesn't make the book, I don't think.
Yeah. The third book of my trilogy, which I'm clearly going to bang on about all morning, was called God's Lonely Man, and that was the title of it from the start. It's about a murderer, and that title just seemed appropriate. And I don't know there's a Thomas Wolfe essay called God's Lonely Man, which is kind of about existentialism, but it's also a line in Taxi Driver, if any of you have seen Taxi Driver, and the voiceover with Robert De Niro refers to himself as God's Lonely Man. And I had this title all the way through, and it was actually quite deeply into the book. The title itself was it seemed to imbue the book with a great bleakness and depressiveness, actually. And then just before I delivered it, my publisher said, we can't use this title. And I said, why? And they said, well, in America, people might be offended by having God in the title. And I know. And I said, Edwin, I am an artist. I cannot compromise my talent. It's now being called The Thing Itself. I did change the title. I was very disappointed to do so. Going back to the resolution thing, years ago I was lucky enough to interview a guy called John Fowles, the French Lieutenant's Woman and the Magus. Yeah. If any of you remember reading the Magus, where you want to find out in the course of this book why this man is having all these things happen to him, and at the end he's sitting on a park bench waiting for this guy Conchise to come to explain to him why he's been doing all these terrible things to him, and Conchise never arrives, and the last sentence of the book is actually in Greek. I remember getting to the end of that book and hurling it across the room, thinking, I have no idea, I just enjoyed these 500 pages, but what happened? I have no idea what happened. I mean, do you think that we do have a duty not only to play fair, but to kind of resolve things in a really tidy way, or can we have open endings to a degree?
I think, as you say, it depends if it's going to be a trilogy. You know, you want some continuity. You want some things unresolved. I mean, there's then the issue of, you know, if you're writing a murder mystery, should the murderer get away with it? And I think sometimes, definitely, they should. I mean, there are you know, which you can do in fiction, obviously. And I think, you know, that's quite an interesting moral decision. I mean, you have to make a lot of moral decisions writing a book, but that one, you know, are they going to get away with it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, actually, certainly if you're dealing with amateur sleuths, the chances of the skein of logic which they work out actually standing up in court is complete, you know, so that you can resolve a murder mystery and say, we know who did it. But if you actually took it the next step and tried to
you know, get a court case, it just it'd fall apart instantly, you know, because the reasoning is just not really there strongly enough. So I think that gives you the opportunity to sort of play God to an extent, and you can, you know, you can let people off if you like them.
I mean, do you think that the crime fiction has got a moral kind of duty, if you like?
That's a tricky question. Yes, I do. If only because we can actually set a bad example to people if we don't put that moral component in. It's probably the most moral fiction there is in many ways, and probably the most regimented in terms of the way it's set out and the kind of lessons you're learning from it.
Yeah. I mean, you're dealing with a totally amoral world, or immoral world for that matter, in the spy, in the Cold War.
Yes, I am, and I have an amoral protagonist, which can confuse people into thinking that I'm amoral. Especially as he's
first. There have been rumours.
Yeah, but I mean, because it's first person, I think you know, people think that perhaps I agree with what he's saying. But I think it is. I'm trying to make some kind of moral points. But the point that you made about should we play fair? I mean, I quite like messy endings. I quite like abrupt endings and things. I'm not sure. I love the Magus, but I didn't actually remember that it ended. When you said it, I remembered. Oh yeah, it ends with that Greek thing that I couldn't remember what it was. But I think. Somehow, if it had had a really neat ending, if he had arrived at the bench and had explained the whole thing, it would also perhaps have been unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Everything was too tied. If things are tied up very, very neatly, I think readers, I as a reader, rebel a bit and think that was a bit too, you know, maybe it could have been a bit scrappier somehow. So I quite like endings that sort of take you out of things. There's a great Ian Fleming novel on Her Majesty's Secret Service. I don't know if you know where he... He gets married, of course, at the end, and then there's the most, you know, abrupt ending. I'll spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but I mean, basically, his wife gets, you know, he gets married, and his wife gets killed on the last page, and it's absolutely, you know, dreadful, and you don't expect it at all. But it's incredibly effective. It's not a resolution in any traditional sense because he hasn't caught who's done it, and you know, it's set up for another sequel, I suppose. But it just works because, you know, if he just ended it that James Bond got married. That would have just been a terrible ending. You know, it would have been a very happy and nice ending, but it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if the last line of the Magus in Greek said, "Please send £10 to John Fowles, and I will send you the ending of this book."
When I met him, I asked him to translate it for a minute. It made no more sense when he translated it than it did. It was still Greek to me.
It was Greek to be continued.
Because he famously, of course, in French, The Tenant's Woman had two alternative endings, and I thought it was to do with some advanced French literary theory, and he said, I just don't know how to end my books. It was really sweet.
Yeah. But this idea about leaving things hanging at the end of the book for, you know, potential sequels and trilogies and whatever, I got badly put off by a science fiction writer called Peter F. Hamilton, who's actually written some science fiction murder mysteries as well. But he wrote a trilogy, which are actually quite massive books in their own right. And I read the first one and loved it, absolutely loved it. Couldn't wait for the second book to come out. And about 2 years later, it came out. And I started reading it and realised I couldn't remember anything from the first book. Yeah. So I had to go back and read the entire first book before I could read the second one. And then the same thing happened again for the third book.
Yeah, no, I know.
So I wouldn't do that to anybody.
Well, mine is very complicated, so I'm going to, you know, what the four readers I've already got are going to dwindle, you know, very, very, very quickly. I mean, what I was trying to do, and I don't know if you've done more of a series like yours, Jeremy, is in the first one I was presenting events in a certain way, and at the end of it you think, okay, I see that's what the story was. And then in the second one, it's like, actually, you thought you knew what had happened, but you didn't know what would happen. This is actually what happened. And then I do the same in the third one, and say, actually, neither of those two things is actually what happened. It was this. This is the plan. Whether it's going to work, I have no idea.
That's very economical, isn't it? I mean, you use the same plot three times.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. Well, like you, I've just been asked. I've just been commissioned to do books 4 and 5 of the trilogy. Oh, so this story's going to run and run. I tell you.
Yeah. Have you ever read the Alexandria Quartet?
Yeah, that's my base.
I think that's a. I've also done that a little bit, but not quite that much. But I mean, he does this brilliant thing where. I don't know who knows the books, but I mean, there are four books in a series, and you can read them. And his idea was that you could read them in any order, and you would get a sort of different impression of what happened. But also, at the end of each book, he has about 5 or 10 pages of notes of what other things might have happened and where the plot might have gone. And then they all contradict each other, and they all tell different narrators and tell different stories. And I thought that idea of that it's not a linear story, that it could just, like life, go into different things, and there's different versions of the truth.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. I have used that a bit in my novels, where things that you thought were wrapped up in the first book are revealed later on by some, you know, dastardly spy master, as actually that was all a kind of deception operation.
Yeah.
That you know, wasn't quite what you thought. And
yeah.
I love that idea that, you know, you keep sort of stripping it away. And you mentioned Agatha Christie. I mean, of course, the famous thing is Hercule Poirot getting everyone in the library, but she was also brilliant, I think, at having, we were discussing this earlier, having actually very daring twists that completely sort of strip away. You know, you think it's going to be and then actually it's something completely different.
Yeah.
Look away in a moment if you haven't read all the Agatha Christie. Are you going to go quote an example?
It's a bit tricky talking about endings because, I mean, we don't want to spoil lots and lots
of things. No, but in general terms, she kind of played all the tricks you can possibly play. Everybody committed the murder. Or nobody committed the murder, or the detective committed the murder, or the man writing the book telling you what happened committed the murder.
Yeah.
It's like all the options she investigated.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, long before everybody else. You were going to read a couple of
endings. I was looking for endings that I liked, and I'll read three. They're very short. But the 39 Steps, I think, is a wonderful ending. It goes, 3 weeks later, as all the world knows, we went to war. I joined the new army the first week, and owing to my Matabele experience, got a captain's commission straight off. But I had done my best service, I think, before I put on khaki. Yeah. which I love.
That's great.
One of my favourites is The Big Sleep, you know, Raymond Chandler. On my way downtown, I stopped at a bar and had a couple of double scotches. They didn't do me any good. All they did was make me think of Silver Wig, and I never saw her again. this is not crime at all, but I just think it's lovely, which is the ending of Cranford by Elizabeth Gaskell. Ever since that day, there has been the old friendly sociability in Cranford society, which I am thankful for because of my dear Miss Matty's love of peace and kindliness. We all love Miss Matty. And I somehow think we're all of us better when she is near us.
Oh. I think my favourite ending is Brighton Rock, is Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. It's my favourite start of a novel when Hale realises he's going to be murdered within 12 hours in the first sentence. But at the end, I can't remember exactly how the wording goes, but you know, it's when Pinky is dead, but his girlfriend, who thinks that he adored her, has got this record in which he's said how much he hates her. And I think she's just about to put it on the record player when it ends. So it's kind of a grain because you can hope that somehow the record's going to get broken. And in the film, I thought they did a very clever thing, the Richard Attenborough version of the black and white film. They did a very clever thing because they have the being a scratch on the record so that when she puts it on, it just says, you think I love you, you think I love you, you think I love you. And the film ends. The film ends like that.
But there's a horror novel called Black House by Peter Straub and Stephen King, which the end of the last but one chapter, the last line of that is, if you like happy endings, stop reading this book now.
Oh.
And I really wish I'd taken that advice.
Have you got a favourite ending that comes to mind?
Favourite ending? I really like, I already mentioned an Ian Fleming novel, but I'll go again. I really like the ending of Casino Royale, Ian Fleming's first novel, which is one of the bleakest endings, I think, in the thriller genre. And got him into a lot of trouble. Jonathan Cape published it, but they were rather reluctant to. And one of the main reasons they did was because Ian Fleming's elder brother Peter was an extremely successful travel writer, and Jonathan Cape hated Casino Royale and wrote a letter to another Cape writer, saying, "Ian Fleming's written this book. It's awful. I'm paraphrasing. It's awful, but we'll publish it because he's Peter's younger brother." They were very worried about the moral implications of it. And basically, the end of the book is that, actually rather like on Her Majesty's Secret Service, he falls in love with this woman, and he really thinks he's going to spend his life with her, and he realises that she has betrayed him, and she commits suicide. And the last line of the book is him calling back to headquarters and telling M, the bitch is dead.
Yeah.
And it's such a... it's so bleak, but at the same time, I think when you think about it later, you realise that Bond has used that harshness to disguise his grief. But I think the first time you read it, you think, what a bastard. But I think over time you realise just how, basically it means that that it affected him.
Yeah.
And I think it's an extremely effective, I think it's probably the most effective ending in a thriller.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my favourite ending probably is a film, I think it was called Sideways, about two middle-aged and wine buffs going through California.
Yes.
And with that, Paul Giamatti, you know, he has a relationship with this waitress halfway through, and then he wrecks it, and then at the end he wants to try and see if he can make things work with her again. And the very last shot of the film is him standing on her doorstep, knocking on her door, and then the film ends. And it's perfectly resolved, as far as I'm concerned, because you can decide for yourself, is she going to open the door and welcome him? Is she going to tell him to, you know, go away? It's just great. I mean, to be able to do that kind of ending, I think, is a real gift. Thank you guys for your patience with me. Let's get some questions from the audience. If you've got a question, stick your hand in the air. Lady there, gentleman there. And remember, the best question wins a bag of books.
You talked about titles, but which pieces of the puzzle do you need before you can write the story?
Oh, that's a good one. Which pieces of the puzzle do you need before you can write a story?
Well, as I said earlier, the setting is absolutely vital for me. Once I got the setting, then I got some of the characters. And then you just start thinking about sort of resentments between characters, you know, and researching, and you sort of find out in any scenario, you know, there are going to be conflicts. So there are people who get on and people who don't get on. And I remember when I was researching one of the Charles Paris murder mysteries about a television game show, and I mean, one reason why I've never written anything historical is that my favourite research method is taking out for lunch somebody who's had the experience. And I suddenly remembered that a friend of mine, and I'd been a television producer and produced some fairly tacky stuff in my time, but I didn't think I quite knew the depths of tackiness. And a friend of mine in BBC Radio, her secretary, had just moved to work on the Generation Game on television. This was presented by, for our American friends, someone called Bruce Forsyth, who, and this was a long time ago when he was still using his own hair. And I took this girl out for lunch, and she just took me through the entire process of how they, you know, how people became contestants. And normally they wrote in to say they'd like to be on the show, and then they were sent this enormous form they had to fill in about all their family background and hilarious things that had happened on their honeymoon, so they could have a bit of badinage with Bruce with his own hair. And she said at that point they had then to send what was in those days a Polaroid photograph. And television was then, and possibly still is, based on the fallacy that everyone is attractive. And she said they had in the researcher's office what they called the ugly wall. And on the ugly wall, they stuck all the photographs of the people who they thought were not suitable for the show. And I thought that was so cruel and so entirely typical of the values of television that it went straight in the book. So I'm not sure that that's an element of a puzzle, but it's you know. And the lovely thing about research is it's like that thing where you hear a word for the first time, and then you see it like half a dozen times. And it's not that it's a new word. It's always been there. You've just not been looking for it. And research is like that, I find, that, you know, suddenly everything becomes relevant. And you're talking to someone, and you realise they might have had some experience, that so you ask them the relevant question.
Yeah,
And it's a sort of focusing thing. With this, in my case, there's always this kind of awful date where I'm going to start writing the book. And, you know, I find quite often when I'm sort of doing talks in libraries and things, I will say, and I'm going to start writing my next book on such and such date, you know, on the principle that sort of blackmail myself into doing it.
Pieces of the puzzle for you, Jeremy?
I do write historical thrillers, and for me, the first thing I need to have is to know which historical event I'm going to write about. So I read a lot of non-fiction about the Cold War and about espionage, about politics, and then I sort of, when I come across something that I find very, very fascinating, you know, I read about that. And when I find that there's something that I really want to explore, so my first book is set in the Nigerian Biafran War. My second book is about stay behind networks and state-sponsored terrorism in Italy. My third book is about nuclear conflict in the Cold War, and I'm currently writing a book about Rhodesia. And so with all of those were the starting points that I wanted, a historical event that I thought was maybe in some way sort of forgotten or could have more exploration done, and that would be a suitable backdrop for the kind of thrillers that I write. That's the first most important element for me.
What are you under?
Usually I find it's just a single image. It's just a picture in my head, and if I've got that picture, I can use that as the basis and just spring off from that in lots of directions. In the first of the Young Sherlock books, it started with just the idea of a crippled man dangling from ropes that are attached to cuffs on his shoulders and arms, and just being manipulated like a puppet by servants who are behind him with a kind of gallows arrangement. And once I'd got that, the whole book sort of spilled out. That was just from a cheese on toast supper with red wine. And then it was 3 o'clock the next morning, I'd just bolt upright in bed, say, "Ah, man, ropes!"
And you're the guys worried about introducing hanging into this, is that right?
But I've also, as well as the Young Sherlock books, I've done a set of crime novels under a pseudonym for the adult market. And with those, I find that once I've got a suitably grotesque death, everything just spools away from that. You've got the autopsy, you've got the investigation, you've got the suspect, you've got the questioning. And it's just the book kind of writes itself in a strange way after you've got that central horrible thing that happens.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Oh, a woman, a gentleman there, then you. No, it's all right, you've done this first. Well, actually, a lot of writers do write backwards, don't they?
Yes. I mean, I think it's quite difficult, I find, to write a book if I don't know what the end's going to be. But that can change on the way. I mean, the one I've recently finished, and I knew who the murderer was about halfway through. And then, when I was doing the last three or four chapters, I suddenly thought, oh, this is a bit obvious. So I changed the murderer, like, on the last day. So you can do it. I mean, I think with I always find with plans and things, you know, you have the plan and you think, and that can happen unless I can think of something better. And it's always the best bits of writing are where you think of something better. A completely new idea comes in from left field and you say, wow, yeah. And that's when writing's exciting, I think.
Yeah. Were you working directly towards that ending that you couldn't use in the end?
Well, no. I had another ending and I thought about it halfway through, but the ending was important and for all my books. It's not all, it hasn't always been very, very precise and it certainly hasn't been the trigger, but I think to know roughly where it's going, but I agree that the best bit is when you sort of have the idea roughly where it's going to go, and then it sort of coalesces and becomes something different, and another idea pops into your head.
I think about it a lot in terms of metaphors, and I've already mentioned the cookery metaphor and the little saucer of pine nuts that gets left over at the end of the book. The other metaphor I think about is just you're driving, and the writing of the book is like setting off a long journey from London to Edinburgh, and you need to know what your destination is when you're setting off. But actually, when you're three quarters of the way up the M1 or whatever, you can suddenly say, actually, I'm going to go to Glasgow instead. But at least you are heading off in a direction and you know what the landmarks are along the way.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. There's no GPS system saying, take a U-turn.
Recalculating your plot.
Recalculating your plot.
Yes, I was just going to ask, are you aware of the influence of the subconscious on your conscious when you're actually writing? And would you deliberately try to dream and use something in the night that you didn't know was there but comes forward?
The influence of
cheese
the subconscious.
Cheese on toast and red wine.
So cheese
yes.
on toast and red wine.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't think I could ever deliberately do that, but I take full advantage of the accidental subconscious images that pop up out of my own mind.
Yeah. I'm not conscious of doing it.
I was in a panel the other day, I think it was N.J. Cooper, said that her subconscious knows better, you know, what the book's going to be than herself, and I think that is true, that yes, it's extremely important and to recognise the great subconscious ideas and to seize them. I go walking a lot and I find that when I sort of just shut down and sort of stop thinking, then when I sort of am annoyed that I haven't done enough work that day, I don't know if you find this, and sort of haven't got anything done, then something suddenly will pop into my head and that's the time to sort of seize it.
Yeah, I think Graham Greene said that, you know, how important the subconscious was to him. I used to do that a lot. I used to live in Sussex and my wife could never quite understand that she'd come home after a very, very stressful day's work to find me lying in a hammock in the back garden with a glass of wine, looking out over the downs, working, because I was just thinking. Yeah. She's now my ex-wife, because she still just couldn't get that. Very sadly. Yes, there.
Ended, as a 30-page preview is next.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
No, that's very annoying.
Yep.
And well, sometimes it's very comforting.
I often do a kind of similar thing if I'm watching things like CSI on television. I'll come up with a much better murderer than they do. Yeah. And I'll be working towards it thinking they're going to reveal any minute that it's that person over there that's the murderer, and they don't. Yeah. And in my own mind, I'm convinced that person really is the murderer, and they just haven't found out.
And I think if you start doing that, then that's when you start thinking maybe I should be writing crime fiction.
Indeed.
Because you realise that you've sort of figured out the conventions and that you've seen how it could go.
Obviously, endings are very important. I think it's, for me anyhow, it's the endings that make me remember a book. And one of the most impressive and brilliant, I think, endings was a book that Robert Barnard wrote many years ago called A Scandal in Belgravia, in which the last line, the ending, changed the meaning of the entire novel. It gave you, wouldn't that be difficult to do?
It's very difficult to do. If I could do it, I'd do it more often. No, I love that. I mean, it's wonderful.
It's brilliant.
And certainly, I mean, also in scripts and that kind of thing, you probably want to do that almost more than in a book. But it's just wonderful if you can think of them, there are very few.
Red Shill is brilliant at that.
Yes.
You can usually get a twist you didn't even think you needed.
Yeah. I think one of my favourite crime novels is A Kiss Before Dying,
yes.
You know, Ira Levin, which those of you
too.
Who haven't read it, I won't tell you what the trick is, but
that's
really clever.
Absolutely.
Really clever.
In cinematic terms, the best version of that is probably The Usual Suspects.
Yes.
Which, for those of you that have never seen The Usual Suspects, A, go out and rent it on DVD because it is a superb crime film. But B, the last shot changes everything you ever thought about. And actually, you cannot do that last shot in literary terms. You cannot do it on the written page. It is a purely visual thing.
Well, I mean, again, without talking too much about my Brighton trilogy, in the third one, I think I've got two really big twists in the last paragraph, and one actually in the last sentence, which does turn everything on its head. Whether it works, I'm remiss to be seen.
Because actually, I mean, I was amazed that they've made films of A Kiss Before Dying.
Two versions.
At least twice, haven't they?
Yeah.
And it's because I'd have thought it was a purely literary convention, but they've done it.
Yeah, so, no, absolutely. Another. Sorry, my hands. That lady there, then these two, if we've got time. How long we got left? To be continued. It's in this.
Well, to be continued, and then it never is.
Yeah, never is. That's right. And then he died, so you never know.
If I could just launch in, because I was actually thinking that through over the past couple of days when I knew I was doing this panel. There's a writer called. Let me start off with a book. It's The Alienist. It's Caleb Carr.
Caleb Carr, yeah.
Victorian New York. Victorian New York,
that's
the wrong
yeah.
psychologist. Beginnings of Psychological Theory, Investigating a Murder. And it's a chunky book, it's really big. And there's a whole lot of psychological dissection of the villain in that, and his possible reasons for doing things, and why is he doing the various things and taking the eyes out of the things. And it's quite an intense book all the way through.
Yeah.
And then the last couple of pages, they track down the murderer and find him, and then either he's shot or he throws himself off a building or something, and they never get a chance to ask him why he did what he did. And I just felt so let down that there was no confrontation at the end of that book. And I thought, well, it's probably an accident. That was just Caleb Carr, who's in a bit of a rush. So I then read his Sherlock Holmes book, The Italian Secretary, and the same thing happens there. There's a psychological dissection of this, and in Sherlock Holmes' terms, quite a sexual crime, and a reading of the villain. And then at the end, he's actually caught off-screen, as it were. And you think, why do you do this? I think he just does not like the confrontations, Caleb Carr. For me, those are the worst two endings that I've
read. What about you? Worst ending?
Not a book, but a film that came out a few years ago called Basic. It's a Samuel L. Jackson, John Travolta vehicle thriller. And it was sort of, it's not a good film, but it's got some interesting stuff in it. But about halfway through, the sort of central, the original twist that the scriptwriters come up with, which was apparently quite a good script, was that John Travolta, who plays some sort of military investigator, some sort of mysterious stuff is going on at a military base, and he investigates. And the twist, in a sort of Agatha Christie style, is that he's the villain. And he's orchestrated the whole thing. And apparently it was all done quite cleverly, and in a sort of, it wouldn't have been brilliant, but a sort of Usual Suspects light style thriller. And Travolta had signed on, wanted to do it, apparently. This is on Wikipedia or something. But he, about halfway through, he had second thoughts, and he decided that, you know, John Travolta is a, you know, my audience doesn't want this. And so it has this dreadful double ending, where it has the twist that he is the villain, and then it has an other ending tacked on that he insisted that they write,
where
he then goes into a bar with Samuel L. Jackson, and they sort of rip off their Scooby-Doo masks and say, actually, I'm not the villain, I'm a good guy all along. And it's just so awful, and it just ruins the whole, you know, it's a brilliant, the first ending, you think, wow, that's actually quite clever for this not particularly good film, and then the other one comes in, and you think, oh my
God. Maybe the ending of my third book, forget I said that about those twists, God. What about you, Simon, worst ending?
Worst endings, I avoid a lot of worst endings because I've got a rule that, the 50-page rule, that, you know, if a book doesn't engage my attention, and I used to always have a contract with the author that if I, you know, the mastermind contract, I've started so I'll finish, until 1981, and I was reading a highly praised literary novel, and as I sort of clambered with crampons up the north face of page 150. I got out my calculator and I worked out how many books I was going to read, you know, given an actuarial sort of length of life. And it was a pitifully small number. And so, with a cry of life is too short for Midnight's Children, I hurled it across the room. And I don't know how it ends, but if it was as bad as the bit I read, then I'm.
John Travolta did it.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
For me, it was the last third of Peter Hoeg's Miss Miller's Feelings for Snow, which is quite an old book. It just goes berserk at the end. It's building up all these expectations in you, and then suddenly it becomes a different book.
Yeah. It does suddenly zoom into the X-Files territory.
Yeah, exactly. It's just really bizarre. I don't know how long we've got left. Oh, 2 minutes. Okay, so a couple of questions at the back there. Yeah.
Nick,
yes, and then you.
I was just thinking. A, the worst ending, and B, completely changed the book by putting, and it was all a dream.
Yes.
Rita Mae Brown did that, as I know, to my... yes, thank you. Yes, yours.
I don't know whether this is apocryphal or not, but Ian Gurney is supposed to have had trouble ending Lord of the Flies, and his wife was absolutely fed up with disappearing into his study every night. when he asked her what to do, she said, why don't you set fire to the bloody thing? And he did.
That twisted something.
Yeah, that was a little twist there. That wasn't the question we were expecting.
I like the ending in your question.
Yeah, it's very good.
Can I pass that on to my wife? apparently I am held to live with one.
I just don't notice things towards the end. Mm. You know, my wife says she can see from the level of glaze in my eyes how far I've... And I sort of, you know, I'll come out from finishing the book and I'll say, gosh, that's nice, the blossom's out in the garden. She says, it's been like that for 3 weeks. So, yes, I'm in a world of my own.
You, Jeremy?
Yeah, I'm in a world of my own most of the time, but yeah, especially when you're coming to the end of a book, it's quite bad. But, you know, my wife also says, look, you know, you do... I know you've got this book to finish, I know you've got a deadline, but you need to empty the dishwasher. There's laundry needs to be done. So, you know, she doesn't let me get away with it.
I'm not allowed to live with anybody, so that's, you know, basically it. It's time, we'll just, if it's a very quick question, then a very quick answer.
I wondered whether sometimes you get to, you finish the book and then realise that the ending you've decided on has caused continuity problems in the book itself.
Well, very briefly.
It does happen, and you go back and sort them out. I mean, it can do.
The worst thing is, you know, it gets printed and either you're reading it in proofs or worse, you're reading the hardback edition that's just been sent through and you read the last page and think, oh no, what have I done?
Yes, you hope your editor will spot the holes and point them out beforehand. And if not, you have that experience.
Yes. You already know the mess I've made, so I won't even say. thank you all for coming. Our authors will be signing copies of their books next door immediately. The prize for the best question I'm going to give to the lady about the subconscious. The rule breakers questions.
Oh,
yes. Thank you for coming.